In Vancouver, I am Plante on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. One of the most important books of the year is Arrival City, The Final Migration and Our Next World. It is written by the Globe and Mail columnist and its European bureau chief, Doug Saunders, who joins me from Toronto this day. This book looks at how millions monthly flee the rural areas for urban settings. The move creates arrival cities where a new way of life is established economically and socially. They build communities, save and invest, and eventually they move out and a new set of migrants comes in. Going to a number of cities around the world, Mr. Saunders sees what arrival cities work and which do not. In Toronto, he takes us to Thorncliffe Park. He travels to Nairobi, Mumbai, Warsaw, and more. It's a necessary book and one that lends a light on where we're headed and what this world will look like in a very short time. His website is at dougsaunders.net. The book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Doug Saunders. Good morning, Mr. Saunders.
Hi, Joe. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. This term, arrival city, did my little intro there, did it explain what that means?
I mean, we have enough new words, but I decided I had to invent a new term to describe these places because we don't have a word to describe the urban neighborhoods where this huge shift from rural areas to urban areas is taking place. And I think people are vaguely aware that this is happening in Asia and the Middle East and South America and Africa now, that these parts of the world are urbanizing much in the same way that Europe and North America did in the 19th century, and that this is a shift that involves 2 to 3 billion people changing their status in the next few decades. We're sort of halfway through it right now. And where it's taking place is not in the hearts of cities and not in the remote villages, but in these in-between spaces that are usually on the edge of cities or in the really marginal neighborhoods in the middle of cities. And in places like Canada, we know them as the Chinatowns and Little Italies and, Bangladeshi apartment tower neighborhoods around our cities. In the developing world, they often take the form of urban villages or slums or shanty towns or favelas and so on. And I found in visiting these places and telling the stories of the people who live in them around the world that there's a similarity in the way these neighborhoods are structured and the way they run.
And how are they structured in terms of the infrastructure there? Do they build their own buildings, or how does that work?
That aspect varies, right? I mean, in Canada, we're used to having sort of the low-priced, undesirable neighborhoods of the city taken over by people from other countries who then buy up the housing, start small businesses in it, use the rising property value to finance other entrepreneurship and to pay to put their kids through university and so on and make it upwardly mobile. Certainly in many parts of the world, these neighborhoods are simply squatted on, shoveled into the ground, shacks are built overnight, and suddenly you have millions more people in the city. We shouldn't pretend that Canadians have never had that experience. People don't realize that around the time of World War I, a third of the population of Toronto was people living on the edges in self-built squatter shacks. That wouldn't be that different from the outskirts of Mumbai or something now. That was a third of Toronto's population at the beginning of the last century. So we urbanized in much the same way. But what I mean by the structure of them is how the money moves back and forth. People don't just pick up from the rural village and move into the city as a whole family. It's a very gradual process that often takes years and years as the working-age adults move in and so on. And these neighborhoods serve several different functions. They're a bottom rung on the economic ladder, for sure. They're a place to put your investment and put your savings, because people don't generally move to the city unless they've invested and planned for a long time. And they send a lot of money back to the village. I mean, Canadian immigrants probably send hundreds of millions of dollars every year back to the originating rural villages of the developing world, an amount that that is larger than our entire foreign aid budget by a factor of probably 10 times, and that probably accomplishes more and so on. And then these neighborhoods always have one sort of cog of their machine connected to the originating villages in another country, and then another gear shaft, let's say, going out into the core economy of the city and connecting their businesses to the city, getting their kids educated there, and trying as hard as they can to make their neighborhoods part of the core city. And when things work well, these neighborhoods create the new middle class, the new prosperity in a country. I mean, Turkey and Brazil are two countries that are now ruled by new classes that emerged out of these marginal neighborhoods. When they don't work well, it can be violent, there can be riots, there can be dangerous political movements coming out of these neighborhoods. So I'm arguing, in telling these stories, that we need to pay a lot more attention to these in-between neighborhoods.
And so you mentioned some of those upwardly mobile neighborhoods. There are also those that you mentioned them as well. There's violence, there's political extremism in some cases. Where are those places?
Well, I go to Tehran, where I spent some time researching these neighborhoods, and I would argue that the 1979 Islamic Revolution was not actually a religious thing so much as it was a uprising of people in these marginal arrival cities. Their pathway to urbanization was blocked by inaccessibility of housing. And what you saw happening in 1979 was an Islamic group promising housing ownership rights to people, much more than promising any religious thing. And I find that the current uprisings in Iran are related to very similar tensions. I look at the rise of Hindu nationalism in India, which was a product of the arrival city. I looked at a lot of the tensions in China right now. I go to Brazil and look at the drug gangs that overtook these marginal neighborhoods and look at the policies that turned these neighborhoods into places where this could happen. And in Europe, I go to half a dozen major cities in Europe. I look at the car-burning riots on the outskirts of Paris, which were the result of transitional neighborhoods that had their transitions stopped. I look at the rise of terrorism in the Netherlands, in the outskirts of Amsterdam, and what made that happen there and not in other cities, and so on. So I think I have an optimistic message that these neighborhoods can be made to work, but on the other hand, I am telling the stories about a lot of places where bad policies have turned these places into extremely dangerous locations.
Now, back to the idea that the reason why these people are leaving a rural area, does that mean in the next few years that rural life is over? I mean, it seems to me that
it's over in the same way that it is in Canada and in Europe, which is to say that Canada has something less than 15% of its population living in rural areas, and we have about 2% of our population employed in agriculture. Now, that allows us to produce more food than Canada ever needs, more food, in fact, than countries with 100 million people are able to produce. A lot of the problems with food production in the world right now are caused by the fact that rural areas are overpopulated and are dominated by subsistence-level farming, that is, farming by families for their own survival, and not for the production and sales and export of food. This is becoming a crisis in the world right now. Another crisis is overpopulation. I mean, the world population is growing very quickly, and it'll be expected to peak at about 9 billion at some point in this century before it begins to go down. And what's going to cause the world population to peak and start declining is urbanization, because when people urbanize, their living standards increase by every possible measure, and they also have smaller families. And there's countries that have an overwhelmingly urban population have non-growing populations. We saw Iran, a very religious country that's not into birth control. Nevertheless, it went from having 8 children per family in the 80s to having 1.7 now, so its population's dropping. If we can manage and cause this urbanization to work for us in a good way, then the world's population will peak at a lower level and earlier, and the ecological problems coming out of that will be less. So it is worth paying attention to this in the larger ecological sense and in the sense of provision of food.
Climate change as well? That could be solved, do you think?
I think there's two ways of looking at climate change in this context, one of which is to say that those who are most vulnerable to climate change and will be hurt the most by climate change are those who are the poorest people in the world, whose families live on less than a dollar a day. Those people, three-quarters of them live in subsistence-level rural villages. I mean, people do not live on starvation-level incomes in the cities. Even in the worst slums of the cities are a huge improvement over village life, which kills people. So shifting people out of the financial margin of vulnerability to climate is one important factor. But also, one of the reasons why we have such huge carbon emissions damaging the atmosphere is that we have such a large population. Making sure that the world population doesn't peak any higher than it has to and that it starts going down sooner rather than later would be a very, very important contribution to reducing carbon emissions. I would say we have a much better chance of reducing the number of people than we do politically of trying to limit emissions, which hasn't worked out so well so far.
And the trend in terms of politics, does that mean that whoever the mayor is more important than, say, who the premier is? I mean, we're seeing that in this part of the world, that it matters now who the mayor of Surrey is rather than who the next premier might be.
I think it's very, very important that these neighborhoods have some sort of self-government because I think we tend to treat these poor immigrant neighborhoods as being welfare cases. You know, we assume that because they're poor, they're people who've fallen off the edge or are doing badly. We don't realize that, no, in fact, it's going the opposite direction. These are neighborhoods that are trying to become more prosperous. And, in fact, some of them look poor because they're processing people through at such a high rate. They're sending people out into middle class and home ownership at such a high rate that there's a constant influx of new people coming in from poor villages around the world, which makes the poverty rate look low. And what we need to be offering is things like easy-to-obtain business licenses and flexible zoning on housing so you can turn a house into a shop or a factory fairly easily, higher density housing and transportation links. The people who live in these neighborhoods know what they need and they know how to do it. So certainly more robust municipal governance is important from the bottom-up stuff, because I actually don't think that immigration policy at the federal or provincial level is going to make much difference as far as who comes into Canada. We're going to have, even with a point system that theoretically brings in highly educated, skilled people, still 4 out of 5 people who come in are going to be the uneducated, unskilled relatives of those people. We're going to have poor people from villages in the developing world coming into Canada for the next 20 years, and it's much better to be planning how to make them into successful people rather than trying to control it.
Doesn't that mean, though, that the size of government increases? I mean, people on the right will probably, you know, they'll bring that up and say that, you know, it's a reason why we shouldn't do this sort of stuff, right?
This is what I have to say in this book is both a very free market message in that I'm saying that what makes immigration succeed is allowing people to buy and sell and start businesses much more freely. Getting government out of the way of immigrant communities is a very important way to make them work, right? Not having zoning laws, not having restrictions to ownership of business, and having very quick access to citizenship once you've landed tends to make things work well. On the other hand, I do think that I don't think that a free market in just by itself is going to be the solution, although it certainly helps to make it easy to buy houses and so on. I think things like transportation links that are extremely important, they can be provided by the private sector, but they do need the assistance of government. So it's both a smaller government and a more involved government message, not necessarily a larger public sector, though.
What led you to write this book, Doug?
I became convinced in visiting the places in the world where both the really good things and really bad things are happening that there is a a whole area of life that we are ignoring, which is these transitional spaces, and that the story of this century is going to be told in these neighborhoods. And I wanted to tell essentially the story of the world right now by narrowing the focus of our land just at these in-between places. And I wanted to tell it using the stories of the people and the families who live in them. So I have stories of success, stories of tragedy, and so on in 20 countries around the world.
And how closely did you live with these people? I mean, in terms of how you met them and spent time with them.
Yeah, in some cases, quite a bit of time. I'd visit them at their houses quite a lot and spend a lot of time in their neighborhoods and so on. I had researchers in all the countries I visited who usually spent months ahead of me doing the legwork and finding locations for me. So I could visit China. I visited China and Brazil each for a month and did very intensive interviews and visits in the neighborhoods and so on. And I was helped a lot by having what you might call ground crews in the different countries, people who've lived there their entire lives and know these neighborhoods very well. It was a big team effort, this book.
And it must be gratifying because people are comparing this to Jane Jacobs and the sort.
Well, yeah, I mean that's very flattering, and it was inspired by her. You know, I mean she lived in Toronto and in New York, and she rewrote our understanding of how downtown neighborhoods work and what makes them work, and so on. She was also very in favor of getting government and rules out of city life to make it work. And I'm trying to do something similar, but not with the downtown, with the outskirts neighborhoods.
You know, the other thing that struck me about a section of the book that I read with fascination is the makeup of the family unit. It changes, doesn't it? If someone from the village goes to the arrival city, they usually leave behind children, don't they?
In a lot of parts of the world, this has had to happen because in China, most dramatically, there are 200 million people who are called the floating population because they're not legally city dwellers. The Chinese government does not allow people to become legal city dwellers, even if they've been living and working there for 20 years. As a result, people hold on to their farm villages as almost a social safety net, right? Because they can't get any sort of pensions or health insurance or anything. And they leave their parents and their children there. The children because they can only get legally into school in the villages, the parents because they hold on to the farm and keep it going at a minimal level. And so all over China you get what's called hollow villages, which are all just grandparents and grandchildren. And the parents are off in a far-off big city and get to visit once a year. Interestingly, China's not the only place where this is happening. In Eastern Europe, especially Romania, you get these hollow villages, mainly because working-age adults go to Italy or Spain to fill the huge labor shortages in those countries to take care of people's grandparents or pick the strawberries or all the areas where there's low-skill labor shortages in Europe. Italy and Spain are not very accepting toward Romanian families moving in, even though they're legally full citizens of any other European country because they're in the EU. They make it very difficult to get kids into school there and so on. So again, you get the situation where you have these farm villages, which are well-funded because they get money coming in from the parents, but nevertheless, they're just, all they are is people over 60 and people under 18.
And when they reunite, what happens socially?
I think it causes a lot of tension. It's very difficult for family, and I think sometimes we like to think, oh, they're Chinese, they must look at this differently from us. That's not true. Being separated from your kids for all but 2 weeks a year is emotionally the same for Chinese peasants as it is for us. It's very hard on you. It's very hard on the kids to be raised by their grandparents, who often become senile and die when they're in their most vulnerable teenage years and so on. And you multiply that by 200 million people, and you realize that that China is facing some kind of a social crisis related to its failure to acknowledge the fact that 200 million people have moved into the city and allow them to become citizens there. also an agricultural crisis. It would help a lot if these people were allowed to get rid of their village homes so that people could take them over who wanted to turn them into high productivity farmlands rather than essentially social safety net farms.
Digressing dramatically here, Rona Maynard says I should get rid of my fax machine. You think otherwise? We had this discussion on Facebook, didn't we?
Yeah. I was just thinking about the last time I used a fax machine, except...
Because I'm complaining about the fax machine in my office, that I've used it probably 30 times in the last year. And she says that I should get rid of it because you can just go to the local print shop or something. And since you live in London, you said that Revenue Canada... That
I find that the only reason why I keep a fax machine is Revenue Canada. They will not allow you to scan a document and email it to them. Revenue Canada people are not allowed to use email.
Yeah.
You can phone them and you can fax them. I find it slightly alarming about Canada that we have what should be the most high-tech of government agencies, the Revenue Department, is still reliant on the fax machine as its central communication medium. What does that say?
Yeah, so I should keep it then? Is that... See, I don't know what to do. I've been thinking.
You know, I got an online account for a while there because there's services that if you Google them, you can look them up. There's services that will offer you a fax number, which is virtual, which means that you scan stuff on your computer and you email it to it, and it faxes it. But more importantly, people can fax things to this phone number,
and then
it receives it and it emails it to you as a PDF.
Hmm.
So you can still list a fax number on your business card, but really it's this virtual fax number, so you don't have to have this creaky old machine in the office. I often wonder why I have that thing sitting there, that's for sure.
Doug, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today about this book. I'm enjoying it immensely, and congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
The website for more is dougsaunders.net. The book is called Arrival City, The Final Migration and Our Next World. It's published by Knopf. There is an event Thursday, October 7th, at the K. Meek Center in West Vancouver. Go to capilanou.ca for more information. Thursday, October 7th at 7:30, Doug Saunders will be speaking about this book. It's part of the Pacific Arbor Speaker Series. The Globe and Mail's Doug Saunders on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.